Yeah, I guess Fran called me a couple weeks ago and she's like, you want to come talk at our symposium? And I'm like, not about Postrick Kids. So, but I said I could probably talk about something. And for those of you that don't know, I did my master's degree working on zoopharids. I basically worked on the ironclad groups, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. So basically, Shpinsky and Lawrence published the phylogeny in 1999, and we essentially use that as our framework. It's higher level, subfamily, tribal level, and we basically use that as our framework to work on the species. So that was an excellent publication for me to use to get a grasp and a handle on this group of beetles. So here you can see the six tribes that were identified by Shpinsky and Lawrence. So you have Latimitini, the Usikini, the Philopsini, which I'm going to talk about a little more in detail, the Monomitini, the Pycnomorini, and then the bottom row is all Zoopharini. So some pretty cool, bumpy-looking, relatively colorful beetles. And the Colidiades are split off as a separate subfamily. I'm just going to show this one picture representing the different tribes of the Colidiades. Major amount of diversity is here in the Cinquitini, so a lot of small tribes and a very large one. No real relationships have been proposed in this group, and it's something that hopefully someone will work on someday. Maybe me, we'll see. So this is the consensus tree from Shpinsky and Lawrence, and you can see the six tribes, and those are the two that I am going to talk about. These are the two groups that have been traditionally called ironclad beetles because of their bumpy, rough, very hard cuticle. So I still get a lot of questions. How do you tell a zoopharid from a tanib? So I threw two slides in here to diagnose basically the ironclad, the big group of zoopharids that are most tanib-rounded like. So zoopharids have four fused ventrites. Tanibs have three. It's pretty distinctive here in this picture. You can see the fourth and fifth in the tanib that are obviously movable. And then there's that zoopharid type of procoxal closure is always mentioned as being thumb-like. So it's a lateral expansion of the prosternal process versus this kind of mesad expansion of the hypomeron in the tanibs. So zoopharids, people mention the thumb-like closure. So that's an image of what that looks like. And that's a pretty easy way to diagnose the ironclad zoopharids. So why is Philopsis not grouped with the Zoopharini? All of these characters kind of support it with these more basal groups within the subfamily. I'm not really going to talk about those very much. Throughout my talk, all the things that are in red are hypothesized apomorphies or synapomorphies. One that we found possibly for Philopsis, I guess, is this lobed ventrite. It occurs other places within some tanibs and within some basal zoopharid-like creatures. So why it's not grouped with the Zoopharini. Philopsis, the procoxal cavities are slightly open. There's no antennal cavity. Cetose pit on the submentum of the male, which I'll show a picture of in a second, and some differences in some larval characters. So that's why the two groups of ironclad beetles come out in different places. So here's an example of the secondary sexual characters that occur in the ironclad beetles. So this cetose pit on the submentum is kind of mentioned a lot as being a little bit of a mythical character, and when I first started working on the group, I'm like, you're kidding me. So once you clean the specimens up nice and pretty, you can see right here there's kind of a tuft of seedy sticking out of a pit right there on the submentum, and that occurs in Philopsis and some of the other basal groups in the subfamily. And then in the Zoopharini, most species have this big nodule on the femora in the male, and it varies in size and density of these CD that are inserted into the nodule and location, and it comes and goes on legs here and there, so but it occurs in most species. So these are the species of Philopsis that don't occur in North America. My original project was to to work on only the North American species of Phalaopsis and then the California species of Phliotis. But as soon as we started that project, we realized that it would be impossible just with the natural groupings that were going to occur, and we had to kind of expand outward. So this is Phalaopsis subaraya from several islands in Japan. This is amurensis from coastal Russian forest down through the Korean Peninsula. This is chinensis from north central China, and this is a new species that we described from southwestern China. Two North American species have been into and out of synonymy several times in recent history. We recognize them as two distinctive species, and our best character that we found to separate those is, so on the, especially on the ventral surfaces of the body, between the tubercles, these are pictures of the hypomyron, between the tubercles and the western species, you have all these, you have a dense patch of seedy between all these tubercles, and in the eastern species, it's kind of glossy, bare cuticle. So that was a pretty good character that we found to separate the eastern and the western species of Phalaopsis. So this is what members of Phalaopsis do. They kind of hang out on shell fungi. The only place that I've collected them in is in Glacier National Park on really big standing dead spruce, and you walk up to a fungus and they're just there. And if you walk too loudly, they fall and drop into leaf litter and you'll never find them. But it's a pretty good example of where that group occurs. So I'll take a minute to talk about the differences between what Shabinsky and Lawrence found and then this tree that Mike and I just published. So this is our strict consensus kind of cartoon tree of our four most parsimonious trees. Big differences, the name of Nosoderma had to be changed. I'll talk about that in a second. So that old Nosoderma group is here as Barodes. And then we had this clearly monophyletic group that didn't match up with any of the other Mesoamerican things with 10-segmented antennae. So I'll talk about that too. So we re-recognized this Casey genus, and we moved a few species around based on some characters. Basically, we followed, for the eight genera from Shabinsky and Lawrence, we followed the exact same concepts and definition of those genera, changed some of the names, and then re-recognized Cisaspis. So the Nosoderma type species, it's been accredited to several different authors, Sollier, Dejean, Guerin Menneville, Lacan, Eschholtz, and most often cited with Sollier. So we're tracking down all the literature, and this Guerin Menneville paper was really, really difficult to get, and we actually got it like a couple days before I was supposed to defend. So this is actually the type species of Nosoderma, and that happens to be a species that occurs in Cuba and was not currently in the genus. So we kind of had to change the concept of Nosoderma. So Nosoderma is now restricted to the two Cuban species, and we needed a replacement name for Nosoderma. So there's the Cuban species that is the type species of Nosoderma. So we used one of the Casey names as a replacement name, and it's Barodes. This is an example of three specimens of Barodes, three species of Barodes. So Cisaspis, why didn't Cisaspis fit? So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the problems that we had with individual species and with groups. So this is relatively widespread species that occurs in Texas, but it's pretty rarely collected for how big of a geographic area it occupies. But it's a cool little species. And this was a North American species that didn't really fit in Phliotis. And the reasons why it didn't fit, so Phliotis has a huge antennal cavity on the hypomyron that can completely contain the antenna. And what Cisaspis has, and the whole group has, is kind of this little arcuate groove here. It's not really an antennal cavity, it's just kind of a depression and a little curve in the cuticle. So that kind of caused some problems with the definition of the genus. And then Phliotis and Nosoderma both have, on the ventral surface of the body, they have these big distinct tubercles So Cyspys has seat dose punctures. So we felt that those were enough good characters to re-recognize the Casey genus. Here's an example of a few species. The species in the middle was in my thesis described in honor of Adam, but we got scooped by some Spanish herpetologists. So they described this in 2006. We described this one in honor of Steve Ash. The Kansas folks have collected a lot of zofrans, and so they did some really good collecting down there. Other problem species. So this is relatively common species in collections, and Warren actually collected a series of about 25 specimens, which is one of the longest series I've seen of any of the zofarids, with really good biological data and stuff. So, but this has had this name attached to it in every collection that I've seen it in. And so we tracked down the types in Paris, and we got the type, and that's what it looked like. So it was all these specimens were misidentified in collections. And when it was described, from Mexico. This species barely occurs in Mexico, very, very southern Chiapas. And this is a more northern Mexican species that is south of the Rio Grande River, whereas the Texas species stays pretty much north of the Rio Grande River. So that ended up being a new species. This was the other big problem species. It's probably the most distinctive member of the non-zophorus in the tribe, and occurs in southern Central America. So we had problems trying to fit this into a genus. So if you look at the characters, Verodes, Old Nosoderma, all have this membranous prostica on the mandible. This species, Ensis aspis, don't have that character. One of the characters of Phleotes is this very distinct glabrous tarsal strip, which this species had. And you can see in the area of where an antennal cavity would be, it's not a real distinct cavity that'll totally enclose the antenna, but it's got something there. So that's kind of more of a character of like the other California species Phleotes pulcatus has. So we decided that, and based on our phylogeny, this could be placed within Phleotes, kind of at the base of that Phleotes lineage. So we moved this into Phleotes, we're as comfortable with that as we can be, I guess. one of the other problem species that we had, this is the African Scoriaderma. Again, we got the types from Paris. There were three species, one from the Comoro Islands, one from East Africa, one from West Africa. And we got the type from Paris, and that was the type from Paris. So this is a mislabeled or some sort of specimen from Mexico. It's exactly the same as Verodes scabrosus. It was actually labeled from simply Congo. All that the label said was Congo, handwritten. And there are actually a few towns in central Mexico that are El Congo. That could be one interpretation. But we synonymized that species with Scoriaderma congolensi from Eastern Africa. Another problem species. So this appeared in collections from Venezuela and from Cuba. And one of the specimens that I saw had a Gabin label that's identified it as this species. So Gabin moved this species into the old sense of Muralius incorrectly. And this is a true member of Muralius, so there are two true species in Cuba. This is very distinctive. And this was placed with that group, but has many, many characters to distinguish it. It doesn't have flight wings, but it has all the characters associated with having flight wings. So it has a large scutellum, epiphyteal ridge, larger mesosternal area. So this we moved to Nosorhinus, and there's two species now from South America, Nosorhinus. And this species was just recently described by Garrido from Cuba in 2002. The other little bit of a problem, I guess, historically in California, Phleotes has been divided into a northern and a southern populations, have been divided into two species. When you lay 5,000 specimens of this out on a table, that difference goes away. It's a clinal variation. These whitish patches, you'll get little spots of them here and there, and it's not a real consistent throughout the range of the species. So you do get northern individuals that have these nice white patches, and then southern individuals that are all black, but we synonymize those two with, and Phalaetes diabolicus is the older name. So I'm just gonna run through the genera that we're recognizing real quick. Zophorus, critically and excellently revised by Triplehorn. Very distinctive. Another group of characters that we used that hadn't been used before was between the tarsal claw, this closure of cuticle varies between this complete like wrapping around of the cuticle to being open with an impodial structure. Zophorosis from Eastern Australia, monotypic. It's got 11 segmented antennae. It differs from Zophorus in the antennae, and then it has kind of a setose microvestiture, whereas Zophorus is completely glabrous. Zophir, very, very cool animal, known from one location in peninsular Malaysia, again, monotypic. So this is Nosorhinus from South America, two species, we moved one in. Here you can see that impodial structure between the tarsal claw and how different that is than the character in Zophorus. So your Scoriaderma, East African species again, and we synonymized the island species and the West African species with a species of Varotes. So a single species that's pretty widespread spread in the mountains of Eastern Africa, and there's some diversity here with sculpture and coloring, and with a whole bunch of specimens, it's possible that there could be more than one species in that group there. So this is Nosoderma from Cuba, two species. Phalaetes, like I said, three species now. Our new sense of Sysaspis. So basically what happens in Mexico is the two genera co-occur kind of in central Mexico and south and Central America, and then Sysaspis radiates along the eastern coast of Mexico, and Varotes radiates the other way. So they don't really co-occur in this part of Mexico. So you can see this radiation, and not really the diversity, but the species don't from Mexico don't get up in eastern Mexico, they don't, towards Texas. They get replaced by Sysaspis species. So this is what we are left with. From 8 genera and 68 species in Shklinsky and Lawrence in 1999, we're recognizing 9 genera and 49 species. So we just published a whole bunch of synonyms, and there were several synonyms published by the Spanish herpetologists. But this is what we're left with in the group. And so I want to say thanks to Mike. So Mike certainly has had a few issues in his career, from snake bites to falling in murky water in Malaysia and cutting his leg wide open and almost losing it. So people say that I'm enjoying that picture far too much. But so I got to pour alcohol in there for 4 or 5 days, and then we stayed in the jungle for a few days, and when we got back to the States, he had blood poisoning and almost lost his leg. So Mike has had some health issues before, and talking to him and visiting with him, you know, he fully expects to be back at work in January. So I have no doubt that he will be back working, and it might be good for all of us if he was in a wheelchair for, you know, 2-3 years, crank out some publications. So I know they're all sitting there, but certainly I want to extend my thanks to Mike for all of his help with everything that I've done, and publicly give him my best wishes to a speedy recovery. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Yeah, we have time for about 2 questions.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. But my vote was to go back as soon as it happened, at least go to a hospital. And Mike wanted to be out in the jungle collecting. So we actually we were in one place in Malaysia when this happened, and we still traveled to our second location. And so Mike's kind of hobbling around with like a little cane, and he's got his leg all taped up, and there's flesh flies like attacking through his pants and stuff. And so we sat at this picnic table all day at this research station in Malaysia, and he would just sit there all day. He would walk a few feet from his picnic table, collect some stuff, walk back, and in that little, those little adventures, he got Disculum added adults, larvae, and molecular data. So right place, right time. So he had some good luck, at least a little bit. But yeah, as soon as we got him to the hospital, he was, doctors were like, you either need to go into the ICU right now, or you have to go back to the States immediately. So that's what we did.
Any questions?
Anything else?